Welcome to Rights Watch, a program about human rights around the world from Human Rights Watch. I'm Jessie Graham. My guest today is Corinne Dufka. She's a researcher at Human Rights Watch, and she's documented some of the world's most brutal conflicts. But she wasn't prepared for what she found in Guinea this past fall. The violence began on September 28th. Opposition parties and civil society groups organized a series of demonstrations throughout the country. The largest rally took place in Conakry, the capital, and ended at the stadium. Human Rights Watch found that the massacre of an estimated 150 to 200 opposition supporters and rape of dozens of women and girls was organized and premeditated.
A combined force of mostly Presidential Guard and others arrived at the stadium, deployed around the stadium so as to block the exits, and then fired tear gas so as to sow panic, and then entered directly into the main door of the stadium and began firing immediately and directly at the opposition supporters gathered there. The protesters then began to fall dead and wounded on the field. The Red Berets then went up to where the opposition leaders were speaking to their people. They proceeded to beat them up so severely that they lost consciousness. And at the same time, as the very panicked opposition supporters were trying to get out, the Presidential Guard and others started attacking women gathered there and started sexually assaulting them in some horrifically brutal ways. We documented four women and possibly one girl who were murdered either during or after having been raped.
What was the message that the Guinean government or the Guinean soldiers were trying to send to these women?
Well, it's interesting because Guinean women are very organized politically. The women's movements of the various different political parties that were gathered there play a very important and prominent role within Guinean politics. So women with whom I spoke interpreted these unusual and unforeseen attacks on them as a way of trying to silence women in anticipation of a geared-up political campaign. In other words, the military said, you know, your place as women is not in a rally. You should be home, you know, with your husband and your children. You expect us to respect you, to protect you, and yet you're here, you know, protesting among men at the stadium.
So a message to women not to participate in political life. And these are women who maybe are business people. They're strong women.
Yeah, they're strong women, they're vocal women, and they're very good at organizing other women. Like I said, there were a number of those who I speak with who led sort of the women's arms of various different political parties. And I think for Guineans, you know, they have, for the last 50 years, lived under two very repressive, authoritarian, often brutal regimes. First, Sékou Touré, who took over after Guinean independence, and then Lansana Conté, who died in December of last year. And so for them, they were looking in the face a third authoritarian, brutal military regime, which in part explains the level of participation and the fervor on that day, the 20th of September, to come out onto the streets and say, no, enough is enough. We do not want another military authoritarian regime. We want a free and fair election.
For people who aren't familiar with Guinea, can you just explain a little bit about its significance in the region and its significance to the world as well?
Yes, Guinea is quite a small country. It is the world's largest producer of bauxite, which is the raw material used for aluminum. There are six countries that border it, including a number of them who have recently come out of armed conflict: Sierra Leone, Liberia, Cote d'Ivoire, Guinea-Bissau. Then we have Mali and Senegal who border Guinea, part of a region that share many ethnic groups that traverse borders. So there's really a regional component to economic activity and so on. And we're extremely concerned that if Guinea deteriorates, if the political situation deteriorates further in Guinea, that it could undermine the very fragile security that exists within post-war countries Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Cote d'Ivoire as well. So that's one, you know, big concern. There's been a tremendous effort by the United Nations, by the French, the Americans, the British to bring about stability within some of these other countries. And if Guinea deteriorates, it could really undermine the entire region.
And the country still is not stable.
Guinea. No, it hasn't. And there's been a recent deterioration further when about a week and a half ago, there was very serious infighting between the coup president, Dadis Camara, and his erstwhile aide-de-camp, who we identify as one of the key perpetrators and the key officers present during the stadium massacre, in which this individual, whose name is Lieutenant Tumba Diakite, fired on Dadis Camara, wounding him. So now you have Dadis Camara and another one of the key officers named Captain Tegboro, who are receiving medical care in Morocco, and Tumba Diakite is on the run. So you have now three of the key perpetrators whose whereabouts are either no longer known or else they're out of the country.
It is the first time that this kind of sexual violence has occurred in Guinea that you know of. I mean, it sounds like there's been a huge reaction in the country. People were extremely shocked and obviously very upset about this.
Yes, yes, there have been, and we have documented isolated incidents of rape which have accompanied previous crackdowns, but nothing like this in terms of the numbers and also in terms of the public nature of the sexual violence. And some of the women described, and even men, witnesses who we spoke with, described, six, eight, 10 women being raped simultaneously in and around the same area. And then there were other incidents in other areas. So in the stadium complex and outside by the annex, by the basketball courts, in the toilet bathroom area. So that suggests to us, and also that you have officers walking by when rapes are in progress and doing nothing to actually stop those rapes from happening. So what it says to us is if there wasn't some sort of explicit order given to perpetrate sexual violence, there was some sort of permission given that it would be tolerated.
When I was reading your report, I was thinking about how this has happened in so many places, some places where you've worked. How do we understand how it can be prevented? You know, it seems to me that it's impunity that's the issue here, as you mentioned before.
Yes, it is. And I think it's interesting because we have unfortunately become very used to documenting sexual violence used as a weapon of war within armed conflict situations. But this was a protest. This was a march by opposition supporters. There was a sense of some sort of civil sort of internal strife. And we had simply never seen something like this happen in Guinea. And the Guineans had neither, which is why they were incredibly shocked. And it's a very conservative Muslim society, and of course there are tremendous stigmas there's a tremendous stigma associated with any kind of sexual violence, and the level of grief that the victims experienced was tremendous, really, and also the sense of shock because they simply were not expecting something like this to happen. So. Again, because of that, because it hadn't been a prominent feature, we really do get the impression that there was some sort of explicit given, if not an explicit order given, that this kind of behavior would be okay.
That was Corinne Dufka. She's a researcher for Human Rights Watch, and she's based in Dakar, Senegal. And that's Rights Watch for this week. Human Rights Watch is an independent organization dedicated to defending and protecting human rights around the world. For more about us, including audio, video, and multimedia features, visit hrw.org. Thanks for listening to Rights Watch. I'm Jesse Graham.